Roran stood upon the poop deck of the Red Boar, his arms crossed over his chest and his feet planted wide apart to steady himself on the rolling barge. The salty wind ruffled his hair and tugged at his thick beard and tickled the hairs on his bare forearms. Beside him, Clovis manned the tiller. The weathered sailor pointed toward the coastline, at a seagull-covered rock silhouetted on the crest of a rolling hill that extended into the ocean.
"Tearn be right on the far side of that peak."
Roran squinted into the afternoon sun, which reflected off the ocean in a blindingly bright band. "We'll stop here for now, then."
"You don't want to go on into the city yet?"
"Not all of us at once. Call over Torson and Flint and have them run the barges up on that shore. It looks like a good place to camp." Clovis grimaced.
I was hoping to get a hot meal tonight."
Roran understood. The fresh food from Narda had long since been eaten, leaving them with naught but salt pork, salted herring, salted cabbage, sea biscuits the villagers had made from their purchased flour, pickled vegetables, and the occasional fresh meat when the villagers slaughtered one of their few remaining animals, or managed to catch game when they landed. Clovis's rough voice echoed over the water as he shouted to the skippers of the other two barges. When they drew near, he ordered them to pull ashore, much to their vociferous displeasure. They and the other sailors had counted on reaching Tirum that day and lavishing their pay on the city's delights. After the barges were beached, Roran walked among the villagers and helped them by pitching tents here and there, unloading equipment, fetching water from a nearby stream, and otherwise lending his assistance until everyone was settled. He paused to give Morn and Tara a word of encouragement, for they appeared despondent, and received a guarded response in turn. The tavern owner and his wife had been aloof to him ever since they left Palancar Valley. On the whole, the villagers were in better condition than when they arrived at Narda, due to the rest they had garnered on the barges. But constant worry and exposure to the harsh elements had prevented them from recuperating as well as Roran hoped.
"Stronghammer, will you sup at our tent tonight?"
asked Thane, coming up to Roran. Roran declined with as much grace as he could, and turned to find himself confronted by Felder, whose husband, Bird, had been murdered by Sloane. She bobbed a quick curtsy, then said,
"May I speak with you, Roran Garrowson?"
He smiled at her. "Always, Felder, you know that."
"Thank you."
With a furtive expression, she fingered the tassels that edged her shawl and glanced toward her tent.
"I would ask a favour of you. It's about Mandel."
Roran nodded. He had chosen her eldest son to accompany him into Narda on that fateful trip when he killed the two guards. Mandel had performed admirably then, as well as in the weeks since while he crewed the Edeline and learned what he could about piloting the barges.
"He's become quite friendly with the sailors on our barge, and he started playing dice with those lawless men. Not for money, we have none, but for small things, things we need."
"Have you asked him to stop?"
Felder twisted the tassels.
"I fear that since his father died, he no longer respects me as he once did. He has grown wild and willful."
"We have all grown wild," thought Roran.
"And what would you have me do about it?" he asked gently.
"You have ever dealt generously with Mandel. He admires you. If you talk with him, he will listen."
Roran considered the request, then said, "Very well, I will do what I can." Felder sagged with relief. "Tell me, though, what has he lost at dice?"
"Food, mostly."
Felder hesitated, and then added,
"But I know he once risked my grandmother's bracelet for a rabbit those men snared."
Roran frowned. "Put your heart at ease, Felder. I will tend to the matter as soon as I can."
"Thank you."
Felder curtsied again, then slipped away between the makeshift tents, leaving Roran to mull over what she had said. Roran absently scratched his beard as he walked. The problem with Mandel and the sailors was a problem that cut both ways. Roran had noticed that during the trip from Narda, one of Torson's men, Freewin, had become close to Odile, a young friend of Katrina. "They could cause trouble when we leave Clovis."
Taking care not to attract undue attention, Roran went through the camp and gathered the villagers he trusted the most and had them accompany him to Horst's tent, where he said, "The five we agreed upon will leave now before it gets much later. Horst will take my place while I'm gone. Remember that your most important task is to ensure Clovis doesn't leave with the barges or damage them in any way. They may be our only means to reach Surda."
"That, and make sure we aren't discovered," commented Orville.
"Exactly. If none of us have returned by nightfall day after tomorrow, assume we were captured. Take the barges and set sail for Surda, but don't stop in Kuasta to buy provisions. The Empire will probably be lying in wait there. You'll have to find food elsewhere." While his companions readied themselves, Roran went to Clovis's cabin on the Red Boar.
"Just the five of you be going?"
demanded Clovis after Roran explained their plan.
"That's right."
Roran let his iron gaze bore into Clovis until the man fidgeted with unease. "And when I get back, I expect you, these barges, and every one of your men to still be here."
"You dare impugn my honour after how I've kept our bargain?"
"I impugn nothing. Only tell you what I expect. Too much is at stake. If you commit treachery now, you condemn our entire village to death."
"That I know," muttered Clovis, avoiding his eyes.
"My people will defend themselves during my absence. So long as breath remains in their lungs, they'll not be taken, tricked, or abandoned. And if misfortune were to befall them, I'd avenge them, even if I had to walk 1,000 leagues and fight Galbatorix himself. Heed my words, Master Clovis, for I speak the truth."
"We're not so fond of the Empire as you seem to believe," protested Clovis. "I wouldn't do them a favour more than the next man."
Roran smiled with grim amusement.
"Men will do anything to protect their families and homes."
As Roran lifted the door latch, Clovis asked,
"And what will you do once you reach Surda?"
"We will..."
"Not we. You. What will you do?" "I've watched you, Roran. I've listened to you. And you seem a good enough sort, even if I don't care for how you dealt with me. But I cannot fit it in my head. You dropping that hammer of yours and taking up the plough again just because you've arrived in Surda."
Roran gripped the latch until his knuckles turned white.
"When I have delivered the village to Surda," he said in a voice as empty as a blackened desert, "then I shall go hunting." "Ah, after that red-headed lass of yours. I heard some talk of that, but I didn't put..."
The door slammed behind Roran as he left the cabin. He let his anger burn hot and fast for a moment, enjoying the freedom of the emotion, before he began to subdue his unruly passions. He marched to Felder's tent, where Mandel was throwing a hunting knife at a stump. Felder's right. Someone has to talk some sense into him.
"You're wasting your time," said Roran.
Mandel whirled around with surprise.
"Why do you say that?"
"In a real fight, you're more likely to put out your own eye than injure your enemy.
If you don't know the exact distance between you and your target..." Roran shrugged.
"You might as well throw rocks."
He watched with detached interest as the younger man bristled with pride.
"Gunnar told me about a man he knew in Cithri who could hit a flying crow with his knife 8 times out of 10.
"And the other 2 times you get killed.
It's usually a bad idea to throw away your weapon in battle." Roran waved a hand, forestalling Mandel's objections. "Get your kit together and meet me on the hill past the stream in 15 minutes. I've decided you should come with us to Tirm."
"Yes, sir!"
With an enthusiastic grin, Mandel dove into the tent and began packing. As Roran left, he encountered Felder, her youngest daughter balanced on one hip. Felder glanced between him and Mandel's activity in the tent, and her expression tightened.
"Keep him safe, Stronghammer,"
she set her daughter on the ground, and then bustled about, helping to gather the items Mandel would need. Roran was the first to arrive at the designated hill. He squatted on a white boulder and watched the sea while he readied himself for the task ahead. When Loring, Gertrude, Birgit and Nolfavrel, Birgit's son, arrived, Roran jumped off the boulder and said,
"We have to wait for Mandel. He'll be joining us."
What for?
Demanded Loring. Birgit frowned as well.
I thought we agreed no one else should accompany us, especially not Mandel, since he was seen in Narda. It's dangerous enough having you and Gertrude along, and Mandel only increases the odds that someone will recognize us.
I'll risk it. Roran met each of their eyes in turn. He needs to come. In the end, they listened to him, and with Mandel, the six of them headed south toward Tirm. Tirm. In that area, the coastline was composed of low, rolling hills, verdant with lush grass and occasional briars, willows, and poplars. The soft, muddy ground gave under their feet and made walking difficult. To their right lay the glittering sea. To their left ran the purple outline of the spine. The ranks of snow-capped mountains were laced with clouds and mist. As Roran's company wended past the properties surrounding Tirm, some freehold farms, others massive estates, they made every effort to go undetected. When they encountered the road that connected Narda to Tirm, they darted across it and continued farther east towards the mountains for several more miles before turning south again. Once they were confident they had circumnavigated the city, they angled back toward the ocean until they found the southern road in. During his time on the Red Boar, it had occurred to Roran that officials in Narda might have deduced that whoever killed the two guards was among the men who left upon Clovis's barges. If so, messengers would have warned Tirm's soldiers to watch for anyone matching the villagers' descriptions. And if the Razak had visited Narda, then the soldiers would also know that they were looking not just for a handful of murderers, but Roran Stronghammer and the refugees from Carvajal. Tirm could be one huge trap. Yet they could not bypass the city, for the villagers needed supplies and a new mode of transportation. Roran had decided that their best precaution against capture was to send no one into Tirm who had been seen in Narda, except for Gertrude and himself. Gertrude, because only she understood the ingredients for her medicines, and Roran, because though he was the most likely to be recognized, he trusted no one else to do what was required. He knew he possessed the will to act when others hesitated, like the time he slew the guards. The rest of the group was chosen to minimize suspicion. Loring was old, but a tough fighter and an excellent liar. Birgit had proven herself canny and strong, and her son, Nolfrevrel, had already killed a soldier in combat, despite his tender age. Hopefully they would appear as nothing more than an extended family travelling together. That is, if Mandel doesn't throw the scheme awry, thought Roran. It was also Roran's idea to enter Tirm from the south, and thus make it seem even more unlikely that they had come from Narda. Evening was nigh when Tirm came into view, white and ghostly in the gloaming. Roran stopped to inspect what lay before them. The walled city stood alone upon the edge of a large bay, self-contained and impregnable to any conceivable attack. Torches glowed between the merlons on the battlements, where soldiers with bows patrolled their endless circuits. Above the walls rose a citadel, and then a faceted lighthouse, which swept its hazy beam across the dark waters.
"It's so big," said Nolfrevrel.
Loring bobbed his head, without taking his eyes off Tirm.
"Aye, that it is."
Roran's attention was caught by a ship moored at one end of the stone piers jutting from the city. The three-masted vessel was larger than any he had seen in Narda, with a high forecastle, two banks of oarlocks, and 12 powerful ballistae mounted along each side of the deck for shooting javelins. The magnificent craft appeared equally suited for either commerce or war. Even more importantly, Roran thought that it might, be able to hold the entire village.
"That's what we need," he said, pointing.
Birgit uttered a sour grunt.
"We'd have to sell ourselves into slavery to afford passage on that monster."
Clovis had warned them that Tirm's portcullis closed at sunset, so they quickened their pace to avoid spending the night in the countryside. As they neared the pale walls, the road filled with a double stream of people hurrying to and from Tirm. Roran had not anticipated so much traffic, but he soon realized that it could help shield his party from unwanted attention. Beckoning to Mandel, Roran said, "Drop back a ways and follow someone else through the gate, so the guards don't think you're with us. We'll wait for you on the other side. If they ask, you've come here seeking employment as a seaman."
"Yes, sir."
As Mandel fell behind, Roran hunched one shoulder, allowing a limp to creep into his walk, and began to rehearse the story Loring had concocted to explain their presence at Tirm. He stepped off the road and ducked his head as a man drove a pair of lumbering oxen past, grateful for the shadows that concealed his features. The gate loomed ahead, washed in uncertain orange from the torches placed in sconces on each side of the entrance. Underneath stood a pair of soldiers with galbatorixes twisting flames stitched onto the front of their crimson tunics. Neither of the armed men so much as glanced at Roran and his companions as they shuffled underneath the spiked portcullis and through the short tunnel beyond. Roran squared his shoulders and felt some of his tension ease. He and the others clustered by a corner of the house where Loring murmured,
"So far, so good."
When Mandel rejoined them, they set out to find an inexpensive hostel where they could let a room. As they walked, Roran studied the layout of the city with its fortified houses, which grew progressively higher toward the citadel, and the grid-like arrangement of streets. Those north to south radiated from the citadel like a starburst, while those east to west curved gently across and formed a spiderweb pattern, creating numerous places where barriers could be erected and soldiers stationed. "If Carvajal had been built like this," he thought, "no one could have defeated us but the king himself." By dusk, they had acquired lodging at the Green Chestnut, an exceedingly vile tavern with atrocious ale and flea-infested beds. Its sole advantage was that it cost next to nothing. They went to sleep without dinner to save their precious coin, and huddled together to prevent their purses from being filched by one of the tavern's other guests. The next day, Roran and his companions left the Green Chestnut before dawn to search for provisions and transportation. Gertrude said,
"I have heard tell of a remarkable herbalist, Angela by name, who lives here and is supposed to work the most amazing cures, perhaps even a touch of magic. I would go see her, for if anyone has what I seek, it would be she."
"You shouldn't go alone," said Roran.
He looked at Mandel. "Accompany Gertrude. Help her with the purchases, and do your best to protect her if you are attacked. Your nerve may be tested at times, but do nothing to cause alarm unless you would betray your friends and family."
Mandel touched his forelock and nodded his obedience. He and Gertrude departed at right angles down a cross street, while Roran and the rest resumed their hunt. Roran had the patience of a stalking predator, but even he began to thrum with restlessness when morning and afternoon slipped by and they still had not found a ship to carry them to Surda. He learned that the three-masted ship, the Dragonwing, was newly built and about to be launched on her maiden voyage, that they had no chance of hiring it from the Blackmoor Shipping Company unless they could pay a roomful of the dwarves' red gold, and indeed that the villagers lacked the coin to engage even the meanest vessel. Nor would taking Clovis's barges solve their problems, because it still left unanswered the question of what they would eat on their trek.
"It would be hard," said Birgit, "very hard to steal goods from this place, what with all the soldiers and how close together the houses are, and the watchmen at the gate. If we tried to cart that much stuff out of Tirm, they'd want to know what we were doing."
Roran nodded.
"That too."
Roran had suggested to Horst that if the villagers were forced to flee Tirm with naught but their remaining supplies, they could raid for their food. However, Roran knew that such an act would mean they had become as monstrous as those he hated. He had no stomach for it. It was one thing to fight and kill those who served Galbatorix, or even to steal Clovis's barges, since Clovis had other means of supporting himself. But it was quite another to take provisions from innocent farmers who struggled to survive as much as the villagers had in Palancar Valley. That would be murder. Those hard facts weighed upon Roran like stones. Their venture had always been tenuous at best, sustained in equal parts by fear, desperation, optimism, and last-minute improvisation. Now he feared that he had driven the villagers into the den of their enemies and bound them in place with a chain forged of their own poverty. I could escape alone and continue my search for Katrina, but what victory would that be if I left my village to be enslaved by the Empire? Whatever our fate in Tirm, I will stand firm with those who trusted me enough to forsake their homes upon my word. To relieve their hunger, they stopped at a bakery and bought a loaf of fresh rye bread, as well as a small pot of honey to slather it with. While he paid for the items, Loring mentioned to the baker's assistant that they were in the market for ships, equipment, and food. At a tap on his shoulder, Roran turned. A man with coarse black hair and a thick slab of belly said,
"Pardon me for overhearing your parley with the young master, but if it's ships and such you be after, and at a fair price, then I should guess you'd want to attend the auction."
"What auction is this?" asked Roran.
"Ah, it's a sad story it is, but all too common nowadays. One of our merchants, Jode Longshanks, as we call him out of hearing, has had the most abominable run of bad luck. In less than a year, he lost 4 of his ships, and when he tried to send his goods overland, the caravan was ambushed and destroyed by some thieving outlaws. His investors forced him to declare bankruptcy, and now they're going to sell his property to recoup their losses. I don't know about food, but you'd be sure to find most everything else you're looking for to buy at the auction."
A faint ember of hope kindled in Roran's breast. "When will the auction be held?"
"Why, it's posted on every message board throughout the city. Day after tomorrow, to be sure."
That explained to Roran why they had not learned of the auction before. They had done their best to avoid the message boards, on the off chance that someone would recognise Roran from the portrait on his reward poster. "Thank you much," he said to the man. "You may have saved us a great deal of trouble."
"My pleasure, so it is."
Once Roran and his companions filed out of the shop, they huddled together on the edge of the street. He said, "Do you think we should look into this?"
"It's all we have to look into," growled Loring.
"Burgett, you needn't ask me. It's obvious. We cannot wait until the day after tomorrow, though."
"No. I say we meet with this Jode and see if we can strike a bargain with him before the auction opens. Are we agreed?"
They were, and so they set out for Jode's house, armed with directions from a passerby. The house, or rather mansion, was set on the west side of Tirm, close to the citadel, among scores of other opulent buildings embellished with fine scrollwork, wrought iron gates, statues, and gushing fountains. Roran could scarcely comprehend such riches. It amazed him how different the lives of these people were from his own. Roran knocked on the front door to Jode's mansion, which stood next to an abandoned shop. After a moment, the door was pulled open by a plump butler garnished with overly shiny teeth. He eyed the 4 strangers upon his doorstep with disapproval, then flashed his glazed smile and asked,
"How may I help you, sirs and madam?"
"We would talk with Jode if he is free."
"Have you an appointment?"
Roran thought the butler knew perfectly well that they did not.
"Our stay in Tirm is too brief for us to arrange a proper meeting."
"Ah, well, then I regret to say that your time would have been better spent elsewhere. My master has many matters to tend. He cannot devote himself to every group of ragged tramps that bangs on his door, asking for handouts," said the butler.
He exposed even more of his glassy teeth and began to withdraw inside.
"Wait," cried Roran. "It's not handouts we want. We have a business proposition for Jode."
The butler lifted one eyebrow.
"Is that so?"
"Aye, it is. Please ask him if he will hear us. We've travelled more leagues than you'd care to know, and it's imperative we see Jode today."
"May I inquire as to the nature of your proposition?"
"It's confidential."
"Very well, sir," said the butler. "I will convey your offer, but I warn you that Jode is occupied at the moment, and I doubt he will wish to bother himself. By what name shall I announce you, sir?"
"You may call me Stronghammer."
The butler's mouth twitched as if amused by the name. then slipped behind the door and closed it.
"If his head were any larger, he couldn't fit in a privy,"
muttered Loring out the side of his mouth. Nolfrevel uttered a bark of laughter at the insult. Burgett said, "Let's hope the servant doesn't imitate the master." A minute later, the door reopened and the butler announced with a rather brittle expression, "Joad has agreed to meet you in the study." He moved to the side and gestured with one arm for them to proceed. "This way." After they trooped into the sumptuous entryway, the butler swept past them and down a polished wood hallway to one door among many, which he opened and ushered them through.
Joad Longshanks. If Roran had known how to read, he might have been more impressed by the treasure trove of books that lined the study walls. As it was, he reserved his attention for the tall man with greying hair who stood behind an oval writing desk. The man, who Roran assumed was Joad, looked about as tired as Roran felt. His face was lined, careworn, and sad, and when he turned toward them, a nasty scar gleamed white from his scalp to his left temple. To Roran it bespoke steel in the man, long and buried, perhaps, but steel nevertheless.
"Do sit," said Joad. "I won't stand on ceremony in my own house."
He watched them with curious eyes as they settled in the soft leather armchairs.
"May I offer you pastries and a glass of apricot brandy? I cannot talk for long, but I see you've been on the road for many a week, and I well remember how dusty my throat was after such journeys."
Loring grinned.
"Aye, a touch of brandy would be welcome indeed. You're most generous, sir."
"Only a glass of milk for my boy," said Burgett.
"Of course, madam."
Joad rang for the butler, delivered his instructions, then leaned back in his chair.
"I am at a disadvantage. I believe you have my name, but I don't have yours."
"Stronghammer, at your service," said Roran.
"Mardra, at your service," said Burgett.
"Kell, at your service," said Nolfrevel.
"And I'd be Wally, at your service," finished Loring.
"And I at yours," responded Joad. "Now, Rolf mentioned that you wished to do business with me. It's only fair that you know I'm in no position to buy or sell goods, nor have I gold for investing, nor proud ships to carry wool and food, gems and spices across the restless sea. What, then, can I do for you?"
Roran rested his elbows on his knees, then knitted his fingers together and stared between them as he marshalled his thoughts.
"A slip of the tongue could kill us here," he reminded himself. "To put it simply, sir, we represent a certain group of people who, for various reasons, must purchase a large amount of supplies with very little money. We know that your belongings will be auctioned off day after tomorrow to repay your debts, and we would like to offer a bid now on those items we need. We would have waited until the auction, but circumstances press us, and we cannot tarry another 2 days. If we are to strike a bargain, it must be tonight or tomorrow, no later."
"What manner of supplies do you need?" asked Joad. "Food, and whatever else is required to outfit a ship or other vessel for a long voyage at sea." A spark of interest gleamed in Joad's weary face.
"Do you have a certain ship in mind? For I know every craft that's plied these waters in the last 20 years.
"We've yet to decide." Joad accepted that without question.
"I understand now why you thought to come to me, but I fear you labour under a misapprehension."
He spread his grey hands, indicating the room.
"Everything you see here no longer belongs to me, but to my creditors. I have no authority to sell my possessions, and if I did so without permission, I would likely be imprisoned for cheating my creditors out of the money I owe them."
He paused as Rolf backed into the study, carrying a large silver tray dotted with pastries, cut crystal goblets, a glass of milk, and a decanter of brandy. The butler placed the tray on a padded footstool, and then proceeded to serve the refreshments. Roran took his goblet and sipped the mellow brandy, wondering how soon courtesy would allow the four of them to excuse themselves and resume their quest. When Rolf left the room, Jode drained his goblet with a single draught, then said,
"I may be of no use to you, but I do know a number of people in my profession who might be able to help. If you can give me a bit more detail about what you want to buy, then I'd have a better idea of who to recommend."
Roran saw no harm in that, so he began to recite a list of items the villagers had to have, things they might need, and things they wanted, but would never be able to afford unless fortune smiled greatly upon them. Now and then, Birgit or Loring mentioned something Roran had forgotten, like lamp oil, and Jode would glance at them for a moment before returning his hooded gaze to Roran, where it remained with growing intensity. Jode's interest concerned Roran. It was as if the merchant knew, or suspected, what he was hiding.
"It seems to me," said Jode at the completion of Roran's inventory, "that this would be enough provisions to transport several hundred people to Feinster, or Aros, or beyond. Admittedly, I've been rather occupied for the past few weeks, but I've heard of no such host in this area, nor can I imagine where one might have come from."
His face blank. Roran met Jode's stare and said nothing. On the inside, he seethed with self-contempt for allowing Jode to amass enough information to reach that conclusion. Jode shrugged.
"Well, be as it may, that's your own concern. I'd suggest that you see Galton on Market Street about your food, and old Hamill by the docks for all else. They're both honest men and will treat you true and fair."
Reaching over, he plucked a pastry from the tray, took a bite, and then, when he finished chewing, asked Nolfavrel,
"So, young Kell, have you enjoyed your stay in Tirm?"
"Yes, sir," said Nolfavrel, and grinned. "I've never seen anything quite so large, sir."
"Is that so?"
"Yes, sir, I..."
Feeling that they were in dangerous territory, Roran interrupted.
"I'm curious, sir, as to the nature of the shop next to your house. It seems odd to have such a humble store among all these grand buildings."
For the first time, a smile, if only a small one, brightened Jode's expression, erasing years from his experience.
"Well, it was owned by a woman who was a bit odd herself. Angela the Herbalist, one of the best healers I've ever met. She tended that store for 20-some years, and then only a few months ago up and sold it and left for parts unknown." He sighed. "It's a pity, for she made an interesting neighbour."
"That's who Gertrude wanted to meet, isn't it?"
asked Nolfavrel, and looked up at his mother. Roran suppressed a snarl and flashed a warning glance strong enough to make Nolfavrel quail in his chair. The name would mean nothing to Jode, but unless Nolfavrel guarded his tongue better, he was liable to blurt out something far more damaging. "Time to go," thought Roran. He put down his goblet. It was then that he saw the name did mean something to Jode. The merchant's eyes widened with surprise, and he gripped the arms of his chair until the tips of his fingers turned bone white.
"It can't be."
Jode focused on Roran, studying his face as if trying to see past the beard, and then breathed,
"Roran. Roran Garrowson."
An unexpected ally. Roran had already pulled his hammer from his belt and was halfway out of the chair when he heard his father's name. It was the only thing that kept him from leaping across the room and knocking Jode unconscious. "How does he know who Garrow is?" Beside him, Loring and Birgit jumped to their feet, drawing knives from within their sleeves, and even Nolfavrel readied himself to fight with a dagger in hand.
"It is Roran, isn't it?"
Jode asked quietly. He showed no alarm at their weapons.
"How did you guess?"
"Because Brom brought Aragorn here, and you look like your cousin. When I saw your poster with Aragorn's, I realized that the Empire must have tried to capture you, and that you had escaped. Although," Jode's gaze drifted to the other three,
In all my imaginings, I never suspected that you took the rest of Carvajal with you.
Stunned, Roran dropped back into his chair and placed the hammer across his knees, ready for use.
Aragorn was here?
Aye, and Saphira, too.
Saphira?
Again, surprise crossed Jode's face.
You don't know, then? Know what?
Jode considered him for a long minute.
I think the time has come to drop our pretences, Roran Garrison, and talk openly and without deception. I can answer many of the questions you must have, such as why the Empire is pursuing you, but in return I need to know the reason you came to Tirm, the real reason.
And why should we trust you, Longshanks?
Demanded Loring.
You could be working for Galbatorix, you could.
I was Brom's friend for over 20 years, before he was a storyteller in Carvajal, said Jode, and I did my best to help him and Aragorn when they were under my roof. But since neither of them are here to vouch for me, I place my life in your hands, to do with as you wish. I could shout for help, but I won't, nor will I fight you. All I ask is that you tell me your story and hear my own. Then you can decide for yourself what course of action is proper. You're in no immediate danger, so what harm is there in talking?
Birgit caught Roran's eye with a flick of her chin.
He could just be trying to save his hide.
Maybe, replied Roran, but we have to find out whatever it is he knows. Hooking an arm underneath his chair, he dragged it across the room, placed the back of the chair against the door and then sat in it, so that no one could burst in and catch them unawares. He jabbed his hammer at Jode. All right, you want to talk? Then let us talk, you and I.
It would be best if you go first.
If I do, and we're not satisfied by your answers afterward, we'll have to kill you, warned Roran. Jode folded his arms.
So be it.
Despite himself, Roran was impressed by the merchant's fortitude. Jode appeared unconcerned by his fate, if a bit grim about the mouth.
So be it, Roran echoed.
Roran had relived the events since the Razak's arrival in Carvajal often enough, but never before had he described them in detail to another person. As he did, it struck him how much had happened to him and the other villages in such a short time, and how easy it had been for the Empire to destroy their lives in Palancar Valley. Resuscitating old terrors was painful for Roran, but he at least had the pleasure of seeing Jode exhibit unfeigned astonishment as he heard about how the villagers had rousted the soldiers and Razak from their camp. The siege of Carvajal thereafter, Sloane's treachery, Katrina's kidnapping, how Roran had convinced the villagers to flee, and the hardships of their journey to Tirm.
"By the Lost Kings!" exclaimed Jode. "That's the most extraordinary tale. Extraordinary! To think you've managed to thwart Galbatorix, and that right now the entire village of Carvajal is hiding outside one of the Empire's largest cities, and the king doesn't even know it!"
He shook his head with admiration.
"Aye, that's our position," growled Loring, "and it's precarious at best. So you'd better explain well and good why we should risk letting you live."
"It places me in as much..."
Jode stopped as someone rattled the latch behind Roran's chair, trying to open the door, followed by pounding on the oak planks. In the hallway, a woman cried,
"Jode, let me in, Jode. You can't hide in that cave of yours."
"May I?" murmured Jode. Roran clicked his fingers at Nolfarel, and the boy tossed his dagger to Roran, who slipped around the writing desk and pressed the flat of the blade against Jode's throat.
"Make her leave."
Raising his voice, Jode said, "I can't talk now. I'm in the middle of a meeting."
"Liar! You don't have any business. You're bankrupt. Come out and face me, you coward. Are you a man or not, that you won't even look your wife in the eye?"
She paused for a second as if expecting a response. Then her screeches increased in volume.
"Coward! You're a gutless rat, a filthy yellow-bellied sheep-biter without the common sense to run a meat stall, much less a shipping company. My father would have never lost so much money."
Roran winced as the insults continued. "I can't restrain Jode if she goes on much longer."
"Be still, woman,"
commanded Jode, and silence ensued.
"Our fortunes might be about to change for the better if you would have the sense to restrain your tongue and not rail on like a fishmonger's wife."
Her answer was cold.
"I shall wait upon your pleasure in the dining room, dear husband, and unless you choose to attend me by the evening meal and explain yourself, then I shall leave this accursed house, never to return."
The sound of her footsteps retreated into the distance. When he was sure that she was gone, Roran lifted the dagger from Jode's neck and returned the weapon to Nolfavrel before seating himself in the chair pushed against the door. Jode rubbed his neck and then, with a wry expression, said,
"If we don't reach an understanding, you had better kill me. It'd be easier than explaining to Helen that I shouted at her for naught." "You have my sympathy, Longshanks," said Loring. "It's not her fault, not really. She just doesn't understand why so much misfortune has befallen us."
Jode sighed.
"Perhaps it's my fault for not daring to tell her."
"Tell her what?"
piped Nolfavrel.
"That I'm an agent for the Varden."
Jode paused at their dumbfounded expressions.
"Perhaps I should start from the beginning. Roran, have you heard rumours in the past few months of the existence of a new rider who opposes Galbatorix?"
"Mutterings here and there, yes, but nothing I'd give credence to."
Jode hesitated.
"I don't know how else to say this, Roran, but there is a new rider in Alagasia, and it's your cousin, Aragorn. The stone he found in the spine was actually a dragon egg I helped the Varden steal from Galbatorix years ago. The dragon hatched for Aragorn, and he named her Saphira. That is why the Razak first came to Palancar Valley. They returned, because Aragorn has become a formidable enemy of the Empire, and Galbatorix hoped that by capturing you, they could bring Aragorn to bay."
Roran threw back his head and howled with laughter, until tears gathered at the corners of his eyes and his stomach hurt from the convulsions. Loring, Birgit and Nolfavrel looked at him with something akin to fear, but Roran cared not for their opinions. He laughed at the absurdity of Jode's assertion. He laughed at the terrible possibility that Jode had told the truth. Taking rasping breaths, Roran gradually returned to normal, despite an occasional outburst of humourless chuckles. He wiped his face on his sleeve and then regarded Jode, a hard smile upon his lips. "It fits the facts, I'll give you that. But so do a half dozen other explanations I've thought of."
Birgit said, "If Aragorn's stone was a dragon egg, then where did it come from?"
"Ah," replied Jode, "now there's an affair I'm well acquainted with."
Comfortable in his chair, Roran listened with disbelief as Jode spun a fantastic story of how Brom, grumpy old Brom, had once been a rider and had supposedly helped establish the Varden. How Jode had discovered a secret passageway into Urbane, how the Varden arranged to filch the last three dragon eggs from Galbatorix, and how only one egg was saved after Brom fought and killed Morzan of the Forsworn. As if that were not preposterous enough, Jode went on to describe an agreement between the Varden, dwarves and elves that the egg should be ferried between Duweldenvarden and the Beor Mountains, which was why the egg and its couriers were near the edge of the great forest when they were ambushed by a shade.
"A shade, ha!"
thought Roran. Skeptical as he was, Roran attended with redoubled interest when Jode began to talk of Aragorn finding the egg and raising the dragon, Saphira, in the forest by Garrow's farm. Roran had been occupied at the time, preparing to leave for Dempton's Mill in Therensford, but he remembered how distracted Aragorn had been, how he spent every moment he could outdoors, doing who knows what. As Jode explained how and why Garrow died, Rage filled Roran that Aragorn had dared keep the dragon's secret when it so obviously put everyone in danger.
"It's his fault my father died." "What was he thinking?"
burst out Roran. He hated how Jod looked at him with calm understanding.
"I doubt Aragorn knew himself. Riders and their dragons are bound together so closely it's often hard to differentiate one from the other. Aragorn could have no more harmed Saphira than he could have sawed off his own leg."
"He could have," muttered Roran. "Because of him, I've had to do things just as painful, and I know he could have."
"You've a right to feel as you do," said Jod. "But don't forget that the reason Aragorn left Palancar Valley was to protect you and all who remained. I believe it was an extremely hard choice for him to make. From his point of view, he sacrificed himself to ensure your safety and to avenge your father. And while leaving may not have had the desired effect, things would have certainly turned out far worse if Aragorn had stayed."
Roran said nothing more until Jod mentioned that the reason Brom and Aragorn had visited Tirm was to see if they could use the city's shipping manifests to locate the Razak's lair.
"And did they?" cried Roran, bolting upright.
"We did, indeed."
"Well, where are they, then? For goodness sake, man, say it! You know how important this is to me!"
It seemed apparent from the records, and I later had a message from the Varden that Aragorn's own account confirmed this, that the Razak's den is in the formation known as Hellgrind, by Dras Leona. Roran gripped his hammer with excitement.
"It's a long way to Dras Leona, but Tirm has access to the only open pass between here and the southern end of the Spine. If I can get everyone safely heading down the coast, then I could go to this Hellgrind, rescue Katrina if she's there, and follow the Jeet River down to Surda."
Something of Roran's thoughts must have revealed themselves on his face, because Jod said,
"It can't be done, Roran."
"What?"
"No one man can take Hellgrind. It's a solid, bare, black mountain of stone that's impossible to climb. Consider the Razak's foul steeds. It seems likely they would have an eyrie near the top of Hellgrind, rather than bed near the ground, where they are most vulnerable. How, then, would you reach them? And if you could, do you really believe that you could defeat both Razak and their two steeds, if not more? I have no doubt you are a fearsome warrior. After all, you and Aragorn share blood. But these are foes beyond any normal human."
Roran shook his head.
"I can't abandon Katrina. It may be futile, but I must try to free her, even if it costs me my life."
"It won't do Katrina any good if you get yourself killed," admonished Jod.
"If I may offer a bit of advice, try to reach Surda as you've planned. Once there, I'm sure you can enlist Aragorn's help. Even the Razak cannot match a rider and dragon in open combat."
In his mind's eye, Roran saw the huge, grey-skinned beasts the Razak rode upon. He was loath to acknowledge it, but he knew that such creatures were beyond his ability to kill, no matter the strength of his motivation. The instant he accepted that truth, Roran finally believed Jod's tale. For if he did not, Katrina was forever lost to him.
"Aragorn," he thought, "Aragorn. By the blood I've spilled and the gore on my hands, I swear upon my father's grave I'll have you atone for what you've done by storming Hellgrind with me. If you created this mess, then I'll have you clean it up."
Roran motioned to Jod. "Continue your account. Let us hear the rest of this sorry play before the day grows much older." Then Jod spoke of Brom's death, of Murtag, son of Morzan, of capture and escape in Gilead, a desperate flight to save an elf, of Urgles and dwarves and a great battle in a place called Farthendur, where Aragorn defeated a shade. And Jod told them how the Varden left the Beor Mountains for Surda, and how Aragorn was even now deep within Duweldenvarden, learning the elves' mysterious secrets of magic and warfare, but would soon return. When the merchant fell silent, Roran gathered at the far end of the study with Loring, Birgit and Nolfarel, and asked their thoughts. Lowering his voice, Loring said,
I can't tell whether he's lying or not, but any man who can weave a yarn like that at knife point deserves to live. A new rider, and Aragorn to boot.
He shook his head. Birgit? Asked Roran.
I don't know. It's so outlandish.
She hesitated.
But it must be true. Another rider is the only thing that would spur the Empire to pursue us so fiercely.
Aye, agreed Loring. His eyes were bright with excitement. We've been entangled in far more momentous events than we realized. A new rider. Just think about it. The old order is about to be washed away, I tell you. You were right all along, Roran.
Nolf Avrel? The boy looked solemn at being asked. He bit his lip, then said,
Jode seems honest enough. I think we can trust him.
Right then, said Roran. He strode back to Jode, planted his knuckles on the edge of the desk, and said, Two last questions, Longshanks. What do Brom and Aragorn look like? And how did you recognise Gertrude's name?
I knew of Gertrude because Brom mentioned that he left a letter for you in her care.
As for what they looked like, Brom stood a bit shorter than me. He had a thick beard, a hooked nose, and he carried a carved staff with him. And I dare say he was rather irritable at times. Roran nodded. That was Brom.
Aragorn was young.
Brown hair, brown eyes, with a scar on his wrist.
And he never stopped asking questions.
Roran nodded again. That was his cousin. Roran stuck his hammer back under his belt. Birgit, Loring, and Nolf Avrel sheathed their blades. Then Roran pulled his chair away from the door, and the four of them resumed their seats like civilized beings.
What now, Jode? Asked Roran. Can you help us? I know you're in a difficult situation, but we are desperate and have no one else to turn to. As an agent of the Varden, can you guarantee us the Varden's protection? We are willing to serve them if they'll shield us from Galbatorix's wrath.
The Varden, said Jode, would be more than happy to have you. More than happy. I suspect you already guessed that. As for help...
He ran a hand down his long face and stared past Loring at the rows of books on the shelves.
I've been aware for almost a year that my true identity, as well as that of many other merchants here and elsewhere who have assisted the Varden, was betrayed to the Empire. Because of that, I haven't dared flee to Suurda. If I tried, the Empire would arrest me, and then who knows what horrors I'd be in for. I've had to watch the gradual destruction of my business without being able to take any action to oppose or escape it. What's worse, now that I cannot ship anything to the Varden, and they dare not send envoys to me, I feared that Lord Ristharth would have me clapped in irons and dragged off to the dungeons, since I'm of no further interest to the Empire. I've expected it every day since I declared bankruptcy.
Perhaps, suggested Birgit, they want you to flee so they can capture whoever else you bring with you.
Jode smiled.
Perhaps. But now that you are here, I have a means to leave that they never anticipated.
Then you have a plan? Asked Loring.
Glee crossed Jode's face.
Oh, yes, I have a plan. Did the four of you see the ship Dragonwing moored at port?
Roran thought back to the vessel.
Aye.
The Dragonwing is owned by the Blackmore Shipping Company, a front for the Empire. They handle supplies for the army, which has mobilized to an alarming degree recently, conscripting soldiers among the peasants and commandeering horses, asses and oxen.
Jode raised an eyebrow.
I'm not sure what it indicates, but it's possible Galbatorix means to march on Suurda. In any case, the Dragonwing is to sail for Feinster within the week. She's the finest ship ever built, from a new design by Master Shipwright Cannell.
And you want to pirate her, concluded Roran.
I do! Not only to spite the Empire,
or because the Dragonwing is reputed to be the fastest square-rigged ship of her tonnage, but because she's already fully provisioned for a long voyage. And since her cargo is food, we'd have enough for the whole village."
Loring uttered a strained cackle.
"I hope you can sail her yourself, Longshanks, 'cause not one of us knows how to handle anything larger than a barge."
"A few men from the crews of my ships are still in Tirm. They're in the same position I am, unable to fight or flee. I'm confident they'll jump at a chance to get to Surda. They can teach you what to do on the Dragonwing. It won't be easy, but I don't see much choice in the matter."
Roran grinned. The plan was to his liking, swift, decisive, and unexpected.
"You mentioned," said Birgit, "that in the past year none of your ships, nor those from other merchants who serve the Varden, have reached their destination. Why, then, should this mission succeed, when so many have failed?"
Jode was quick to answer.
"Because surprise is on our side. The law requires merchant ships to submit their itinerary for approval with the port authority at least 2 weeks before departure. It takes a great deal of time to prepare a ship for launch, so if we leave without warning, it could be a week or more before Galbatorix can launch intercept vessels. If luck is with us, we won't see so much as the topmast of our pursuers." "So," continued Jode, "if you are willing to attempt this enterprise, this is what we must do."
Escape. After they considered Jode's proposal from every possible angle and agreed to abide by it with a few modifications, Roran sent Nolfrevrel to fetch Gertrude and Mandel from the Green Chestnut, for Jode had offered their entire party his hospitality.
"Now, if you will excuse me," said Jode, rising, "I must go reveal to my wife that which I should never have hidden from her, and ask if she'll accompany me to Surda. You may take your pick of rooms on the second floor. Rolf will summon you when supper is ready."
With long, slow steps, he departed the study.
"Is it wise to let him tell that ogress?" asked Loring.
Roran shrugged. "Wise or not, we can't stop him. And I don't think he'll be at peace until he does." Instead of going to a room, Roran wandered through the mansion, unconsciously evading the servants as he pondered the things Jode had said. He stopped at a bay window open to the stables at the rear of the house and filled his lungs with the brisk, smoky air, heavy with the familiar smell of manure.
"Do you hate him?"
He started and turned to see Birgit silhouetted in the doorway. She pulled her shawl tied around her shoulders as she approached. "Who?" he asked, knowing full well.
"Aragorn. Do you hate him?"
Roran looked at the darkening sky.
"I don't know. I hate him for causing the death of my father, but he's still family, and for that I love him. I suppose that if I didn't need Aragorn to save Katrina, I would have nothing to do with him for a long while yet."
"As I need and hate you, Stronghammer," he snorted with grim amusement.
"Aye, we're joined at the hip, aren't we? You have to help me find Aragorn in order to avenge Quimby on the Razak,
and to have my vengeance on you afterward."
"That too." Roran stared into her unwavering eyes for a moment, acknowledging the bond between them. He found it strangely comforting to know that they shared the same drive, the same angry fire that quickened their steps when others faltered. In her, he recognized a kindred spirit. Returning through the house, Roran stopped by the dining room as he heard the cadence of Jode's voice. Curious, he fit his eye to a crack by the middle door hinge. Jode stood opposite a slight blonde woman who Roran assumed was Helen.
"If what you say is true, how can you expect me to trust you?" "I cannot," answered Jode. "Yet you ask me to become a fugitive for you?"
"You once offered to leave your family and wander the land with me. You begged me to spirit you away from Tirm."
"Once? I thought you were terribly dashing then, what with your sword and your scar?"
"I still have those," he said softly.
I made many mistakes with you, Helen. I understand that now. But I still love you and want you to be safe. I have no future here. If I stay, I'll only bring grief to your family. You can return to your father, or you can come with